Anything further?
Thank you, Ms. Longshot.
Thank you.
Ms. Scobie.
May it please the court, this court should affirm the denial of petitioner's request for habeas corpus relief. I think that, as recognized by the court's questions today, that the only context within which Mr. Rinkles can get review of his Stumbelt claim is within the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. His freestanding Stumbelt claim was procedurally defaulted, and whether you look at his freestanding IAC claim or whether you look at the IAC claim to satisfy the cause requirement to get around procedural default, the focus is on ineffective assistance of counsel. This is not a visible restraint case. No matter how hard petitioner attempts to jam this case into a visible restraint case, it's not a visible restraint. Stun belts are not visible restraints.
Now, I think in your brief you indicated that there were no findings by the Indiana Supreme Court that were contrary to the findings by the post-conviction relief court, right?
Correct.
In other words, the Indiana Supreme Court went along and discussed the claims of the petitioner, but never made a finding that the restraints were visible.
In regards to the freestanding Stumbelt claim, the Indiana Supreme Court found that claim procedurally defaulted, so it didn't review it on the merits. It did review the ineffective assistance of counsel claim for failure to object to the Stumbelt. And in connection with that claim, first they reiterated what petitioner's claim was, and that's where the conspicuous to seven jurors comes from.
I cannot understand. I tell you, I read your brief over and over and over again, and I cannot understand where you are coming from. The Supreme Court said the following about whether the jurors could see the stun belt. Quote, Rinkles asserts the utilization of the stun belt, which was conspicuous to at least seven jurors. It doesn't say which he maintains was conspicuous. It says which was conspicuous to at least seven jurors. Undermined his undermined his presumption of innocence and made him appear dangerous and uncontrollable. And then several pages later, when they're assessing his ineffective assistance claim, the court said, and I quote again, counsel opted for the stun belt because they thought the jurors would not be able to see it. Obviously, they were later proven wrong. I just don't get your argument at all.
On the first quote, everything you stated comes after Rinkles asserts.
In fact, you never mentioned the second quote in your brief. You only, given us the first quote.
That was because appellant didn't mention the second quote in their brief either. And so I was addressing the portion of the opinion that they pointed to. I didn't know that they were attempting to use that also as a factual finding. In order for that to be a factual finding, the Indiana Supreme Court would have had to find two errors with the post-conviction court implicitly by saying those two things. First of all, they don't set aside post-conviction court's findings of fact unless those findings are clearly erroneous. And here they don't say anything about clearly erroneous. Secondly, there were only three juror affidavits before the post-conviction court. The extra four affidavits were attempted to be submitted after judgment and just an extra motion, let me reopen the evidence and put in these extra four affidavits. The state had no opportunity at all to respond to those affidavits, and in fact, the post-conviction court refused to reopen the case to admit the four affidavits.
Well, how did that get before the Supreme Court then?
On an offer to prove. They were part of the record because they were submitted, so they were court filings. But they were never admitted as evidence. And the state had no opportunity ever to respond to those affidavits in any way. Judgment had already been entered, and it was closed. Petition was just attempting to reopen the evidence to add the affidavits after the post-conviction court had ruled against them.
I just am having such a hard time, Mr. Kobe, with your argument in the briefs that there's no evidence in the record to, you know, to support it. It's, you know, when you read the affidavits of the jurors, all three submitted to the post-conviction court established that the jurors were aware of the stun belt. And the additional four affidavits that were before the appellate court, whether they were formally part of the record or not, reaffirmed that conclusion. And, you know, as we just heard, several of the affidavits describe exactly what the stun belt looked like. And for the state to suggest that nothing in the record supports the conclusion that the jurors could see the stun belt has me just shaking my head. If anything, nothing supports the post-conviction court's rather odd conclusion that they did not see it. And I think that conclusion would be irrelevant in any case because on appeal the court acknowledged that the jurors saw the belt. And that's the finding by which this court is bound. And all you have to do is take a look at Mendiola versus Schomig. State appellate court's findings are entitled to the same respect that trial judges' findings receive. What is more, 2254E1 does not require findings to be based on evidentiary hearings. If the state court's finding is supported by the record, then it is presumed to be correct.
Let me start at the beginning.
Sorry.
No, let me start at the beginning there of your comments. First of all,
we
don't know that the jurors' descriptions of the stun belt were accurate. We have no idea what the stun belt looked like in this case. No evidence was put before the post-conviction court about the stun belt, about how it worked, when it was placed on him, how it was controlled by
there was
the bailiff.
There was only one in the county, right?
We don't know. That's not in the record. I don't know.
Well,
I don't know if there was one belt or more than one belt. There is no evidence in the record one way or the other, and I don't even know extra record information.
Are you certain of that?
Yes, that the record doesn't show that there was only one belt in the county.
Well, what would suggest that?
I assume that counsel's going off personal knowledge of the status of whether there was more than one stun belt by talking to defense counsel. I don't know where the source of that information is. The only information about the stun belt presented to the PCR court was testimony from both trial counsel, which said he was wearing a stun belt and it was underneath his clothes. Counsel was asked, did the jury see it? Counsel responded, I don't know how they would have. It was underneath his clothes.
Of course, is this the same counsel who didn't know that was the law?
I would suggest that these counsel were both Indiana Trial Rule 24 qualified for a death penalty case. These were qualified counsel. This wasn't counsel doing his first case ever. They had both sat on death penalty cases before. So the suggestion that they would have no idea that shackling would ever be an issue in having the defendant shackled before the jury. Obviously, they knew shackling was an issue because they wanted to use a restraint that wouldn't be seen to the jury. Obviously, they knew that there was a problem with presenting the defendant before the jury in restraints. And that gets back to, at the time counsel made the decision of whether to object or not to the belt, it was the understanding that this would not be a visible restraint. They had no objection to make under the U.S. Supreme Court law, which makes clear they're talking about visible restraints. Illinois v. Allen and Holbrook v. Flynn both make clear that they are talking about visible restraints. There was no clearly established federal law, and there, in fact, at this point, there wasn't even any federal law, any circuit law on stun belts themselves.
Let me ask you this so I just can frame it up for myself, Mr. Kobe. Is it your position that of the seven affidavits that you and Judge Rovner were speaking of, four of them shouldn't have been considered at all because they were not tested? That is, they were the Supreme Court reached into a submission to them, and the state did not get a chance to challenge those four. Am I right? Is that your position? I'd say those four.
Right. The post-conviction court actually refused to admit them into evidence.
So they were not, but the Supreme Court chose to, I guess, review them in some fashion, But your position is that that did not emerge from the trial court record.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
As to the trial court record, we have what, live testimony from two counsel?
Correct.
Who indicate that they don't understand how it could have been seen. Is that your position?
One attorney was asked how the jury could have seen it. The other attorney was never asked about,
right.
about
and they were,
that.
They so. Were subject to cross by counsel?
Right.
Okay. And now, so that's the two. So as to the three affidavits that were accepted by the post-conviction trial court, which one of those spoke to viewing at the trial as opposed to hearing from the bailiff or reading in the newspaper, or don't we know? In other words, which speaks to a knowledge acquired as a visual observation during trial?
The only one that talks about a visual observation is from Juror Kraft. But she follows that up by saying, I think I learned about it from the newspaper. So she says, the belt was visible at trial, but I learned about it in the newspaper. So I'm not sure whether she was saying, I saw something at trial, but I learned it was a stun belt after reading the newspaper account of the trial. I don't know what she meant by that.
What kind of examination has had of her testimony?
It's an affidavit.
Is there any counter affidavit? You're quite right.
No, not about her.
Okay.
About her. The other two affidavits that came in, one juror said they became aware of the belt, but they don't know how, and they don't. And the juror was never told why he was in a stun belt. The final affidavit, I think that affidavit also mentions the bailiff. The second affidavit says we heard it from the bailiff, but we weren't told why he's in the belt. The final affidavit said that we learned about the belt from the judge. Now, there's nothing in the record at all of the judge talking with the jury. So for the judge to do that, it would have been an ex parte communication by the trial judge. So you have to assume that the trial court judge violated the law by talking to the jury about the stun belt outside the presence of the parties. And here there's no evidence besides the juror affidavit that it said it may have been the judge that told us that.
So I would you say that, again, referring to colloquy with in response to Judge Rovner's questions, would you acknowledge then that the Indiana Supreme Court is in effect overruling the findings of the post-conviction report by its comments about obviously wrong and the other quote? I will obviously go through it.
I don't think that that's what the Indiana Supreme Court was doing.
What were they doing?
I think that obviously the jurors, it became visible, was an aside. It had nothing to do with their determination of the issue. I think that they were saying to defendant that we look at the time counsel should have objected, that it became visible to the jurors later. That doesn't affect counsel's decision at the time. Counsel's decision at the time was he's going to be put in a restraint that's not going to be seen by the jurors. The fact that later the jurors may have seen it, that doesn't matter for counsel's decision at the time he made it. Speaking to the ineffectiveness. Even if you take that as a finding, though, petitioner is still not shown prejudice because the guilt is overwhelming in this case. And no matter how petitioner tries to paint it, he parked in the middle of the night. Petitioner parked a block away from the house. He put on camouflage clothing. He painted his arms, his face, armed himself with a .357 Magnum and a knife, went to the house, cut the phone lines, entered the house, shot his brother-in-law, who was unarmed, four times, came out, then confronted his estranged wife, who shot him, and he shot her. Then he proceeded to chase after his sister-in-law, catch her and shoot her in the face.
And his position was that last shooting was self-defense, wasn't it?
No, the last shooting of the sister-in-law, which he shot in the face, at trial was that was a mistake, that he accidentally ran into her and the gun must have gone off.
Now, what strategic basis did counsel offer for failing to present the evidence that at the time of the murders, Wrinkles was delusional, having more methamphetamine in his body than anyone had ever seen or some such, and believed that people were plotting to keep him from his children.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm just wondering what strategic basis the counsel, his counsel, offered for failing to offer that evidence.
They did offer that evidence. The only evidence that they didn't offer was this test of his hair that was done during post-conviction, which indicated that he was a chronic methamphetamine user, which at trial that wasn't even disputed. Both parties didn't contest that he was a methamphetamine addict, and Wrinkle's expert at trial testified that he was suffering from a personality disorder, paranoid delusional disorder, that was aggravated by his methamphetamine use. The state didn't contend that he didn't use meth and that he didn't use meth on the night of the murders. The state's contention was that doesn't excuse his behavior. He talks about in graphic detail his version of what happened in the house that night. It's not a case where he says, I was so impaired I can't remember what happened or I didn't know what I was doing. He just says that I was responding to a threat that I perceived. So this evidence was presented. I think his claim now is that counsel didn't do a good job of presenting it. But that's different than that it wasn't presented at all.
The affidavits and these matters are on the appeal from the post-conviction court.
Correct.
Record. And it seems to me that the Indiana Supreme Court used this occasion to actually set down a new law, prohibition in Indiana with regard to stun belts. I mean, that wasn't really a part of the
correct
case in it.
Correct. And if you look at the post-conviction court's findings on this issue, the post-conviction court goes through each affidavit and makes a credibility determination given the rest of the evidence in the case and says, this is why. The bailiff who submitted an affidavit said, I was the only one to communicate with the jury, and I didn't tell them about the belt. Now, there's evidence, I think, from, and I'm not sure if this made it into the record or not, I can't remember, but a supplemental affidavit from the bailiff regarding a time when he was away and there was another bailiff who in court sat for a time during court proceedings. But it's clear that the bailiff that gave the affidavit was the one that was in charge of the jury while they were sequestered. But whether the belt was visible to the jury later on does not affect the performance prong of Strickland at the beginning of whether counsel was ineffective for failing to object to the stun belt at the beginning. Now, it may come into arguing prejudice when we argue the prejudice prong, but it does not inform anything in the performance prong, especially when counsel testified it wasn't visible.
Simply thinking that the belt would be invisible doesn't mean there was no objection to be made. In fact, when you take a look at Wrinkles 2, when the Supreme Court laid down the prospective categorical rule that the use of stun belts would not be permitted in the state of Indiana, it was largely because the mental anguish that results from simply wearing the stun belt. That alone, the court said, would restrict a defendant from participating in his own trial. And you know, after his belt began buzzing during trial, counsel said, don't make any sudden movement. And that's a directive, it seems to me, that makes it as difficult to participate in one's own trial as if he would have been wearing the shackles, because what, just think about the fear that's instilled in, you know, the wearer of a stun belt. 50,000 volts at 8-second intervals, you know, these shocks of electricity that cannot be stopped once they're activated. And surely you would agree, I take it, that it has a chilling effect on participating in the trial. So counsel's choice at trial, I would submit, was not between an innocuous, invisible stun belt and noticeable shackles. So
let me try to start from the beginning again. That at the time they made the decision, it's not a question of whether they could have looked around and tried to come up with some argument they could have made, but whether the trial court would have been compelled to sustain their objection. And there was no law that would have compelled the trial court to sustain the objection. In regards to whether this chilled his defense, the evidence is clear that it didn't. Both trial counsel testified at post-conviction that Rinkles was able to help them in presenting his defense, had no problems, didn't complain about an inability. They were asked point blank, did Rinkles ever tell you that he feels like he can't communicate with you? And trial counsel said no. Rinkles took the stand in his own defense. In that record, there's nothing to indicate that he was chilled in any way in his testimony. In cross-examination, he challenged the prosecutor, was, in fact, hostile to some of the prosecutor's questions. So there's no indication that he acted any differently. Plus, we don't even have Rinkle's own testimony at post-conviction. He doesn't testify, which he was allowed to do and could have easily done, testified that this belt, I was scared the whole time during trial. In regards to counsel's statement, don't make any sudden moves, that was in response to right before Rinkles was going to testify. Rinkles asked where he should put his hands. And counsel said, well, I'm not sure. All I can tell you is not to make any sudden moves. So it wasn't after the buzzing of the belt because of a low battery. That was in response to a direct question from Rinkles.
Let me just note, as to your statement that, you know, there was no law at that time, that, you know, that of course in 1970 we had Illinois versus Allen and the Supreme Court's holdings that restraint should be used only as a last resort. And here you have, you know, a judge who in every high-profile case was using shackles and stun belts.
I would submit that that's not in the record either. That is a guess, and even the Indiana Supreme Court said apparently that was this judge's practice, but there is no evidence in the record that it was. That was just a guess of perhaps that's why he was put in the stun belt, because there are no reasons put on the record. So that was more counsel's argument that it must have been that the only reason he was put in the stun belt was because this was a high-profile trial. Illinois v. Allen makes clear that it's talking about visible restraints. And as courts have looked at stun belt issues, even the supplemental authority submitted by Rinkles, the Durham case out of the 11th Circuit, the 11th Circuit says there, we've never had the opportunity to consider whether stun belts offer the same problems that other restraints do. So now we're going to look at that.
You know, I was wondering about something in your brief, because in your brief you posit that an objection to the stun belt at trial may actually have worked against him, because the judge might have been able to make a record about why the stun belt was necessary. And I'm wondering if you're suggesting that there are actually any facts indicating that that the restraints at trial were necessary.
We don't know. And because of the way petitioner presented his case at the post-conviction court, only presenting cursory affidavits from some jurors that weren't subject to cross-examination, and weren't explained and were internally inconsistent with themselves and inconsistent with each other. Only two of the jurors said the belt was actually visible, one juror that from an affidavit that was admitted and one juror that the affidavit wasn't admitted. And that goes in direct, that's in direct conflict with the case law and I think an understanding that the electrodes would have to be against the body to properly work rather than to be outside the clothing. It would seem to indicate that it was underneath his clothing as counsel testified to.
Does the literature or any instructions that might accompany the stun belt indicate how it's to be placed?
The difficulty is, in this case, we don't know the manufacturer of the belt. We don't know, because there's not just one company that makes the belt. But in all the cases, it seems to indicate that it's worn against the skin. I haven't seen any belt described by a court in reviewing a stun belt claim that indicated that it was worn outside the clothing. Really, what we have here is an inadvertent sighting, at most, by the belt. And this court made clear in Harrell v. Israel, inadvertent sighting.
Sighting?
An inadvertent sighting by the jury. Steps were taken to avoid the jury seeing the restraints. And if you take the Indiana Supreme Court's finding as a finding, which I don't believe it is, and find that the jurors saw it, it was inadvertent. No one meant for it to happen. And so it should, and this court in Harrell v. Israel said, inadvertent sightings don't constitute prejudice to reverse. And that's what we have here. If there are no further questions, the state asks that this court affirm the denial of habeas corpus relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coben. Ms. Longshot.
My friends and family tease me because I speak so quickly. Now you're going to get a witness of that. A couple of things.
Don't feel time pressure.
Thank you. I want to correct the record and give the court appropriate cites for a number of things. Thank you, Chief Judge Flom. Post-conviction testimony of lead counsel, Mr. Danks, at post-conviction record 1144. There's a discussion of did they put the same belt back on Mr. Wrinkles after it had misfired. And the question, the same belt that had just caused this scene? Answer, I believe so, yeah. I think they only had one. That was lead counsel's testimony. The description of the stun belt that is given by Juror Kraft in her affidavit matches the description given by trial counsel of the same belt. I would refer the court to Juror Kraft's affidavit at post-conviction record, page 612, where she describes the width of the belt. That same width, ironically, was given by Mr. Wrinkle's trial counsel, lead counsel. His testimony is at page 1138 of the post-conviction record. So under his clothes or not, they're at least getting descriptions that are the same, and certainly down to the width of the belt, they match, trial counsel and the juror.
Ms. Longshire, what do you make of the fact the post-conviction trial court found the four affidavits wanting, and even accepting Ms. Kraft not being inconsistent, but arguably maybe her viewing of something became confirmed by a subsequent reading, and the lack of any further development of this setting at that opportunity, which of course is what post-conviction is for in large measure. Don't we have a pretty underdeveloped record on what you need to have here to establish the kind of prejudice we need to find?
I think the record is fine. I think the problem is with the post-conviction court's findings that were not drafted by the post-conviction court, that were drafted by the state of Indiana to begin with.
The law is full of civil and criminal submissions by counsel, able counsel like yourself, that trial courts find acceptable. Some judges edit and some draft pretty original findings, and others find the presentation a summation that they can accept. So how do we get to where you want us to go on the adoption of the state? Don't worry about the time. How do we get to the adoption of that, because there's a, if you would call it a wholesale acceptance of state,
I would.
I'm sure you would, that isn't somehow overwhelmed the trial judge's analysis.
Well, I guess if we look at what the Indiana Supreme Court was asked to do. The Indiana Supreme Court was asked to overturn the post-conviction court's finding. So what options did the Indiana Supreme Court have? It could have remanded the case back and said, well, I'm going to order you to put these in the record, and if the state wants to do counter-affidavits, that's okay by us. They could have said, I want you to have an evidentiary hearing again and have all these witnesses testify. However, the Indiana Supreme Court chose to reach the resolution it reached, respectfully, is up to the Indiana Supreme Court. And what they chose to do was to resolve the factual issue in the way they did. Maybe that is because the affidavits were consistent. Now, we don't know who told us about how the belt was activated. You know, there are some inconsistencies.
Well, they didn't really make a finding. I mean, there was certainly, as Judge Hovind referred to, obviously they were later proven wrong, but that's in the discussion of how bad stun belts are and they shouldn't be used and we ought to outlaw them, which was sort of a subset of actually deciding this case.
I think that's, I mean, I can understand why you'd say that, but I think we also have to look at how the case was presented to them. The matter of the post-conviction judge's findings was presented to them hard and heavy by Mr. Ringel's lawyers. I mean, this was up front and center for obvious reasons. I mean, as a litigant, I want to be in the category of inherently prejudicial errors. And that's the place I want to be. If I'm representing Mr. Ringels, that's where I want to be. And that's where his lawyers recognized there was a problem. And so from the very beginning, again, motions, let us reopen, let us supplement the record, let us do this, let us do that, in the post-conviction court. And then in the Indiana Supreme Court, we have a problem. This fact-finding is clearly erroneous. I mean, if this were some aside where this wasn't a front-and-center argument, you might be able to get a tiny piece of a concession out of me, but this was front and center in this brief for obvious reasons. The lawyers representing him had in their possessions affidavits from seven jurors and a fact-finding that was problematic, and asked the court to please resolve the issue, claiming clearly erroneous.
So your position, arguably, would be that they should have remanded it for a hearing.
I think they could have remanded. I think they could have remanded. I did try to look for some cases where the Indiana Supreme Court has found, as a matter of fact, things are clearly erroneous. Having never been a judge, I don't know if that's something that one needs to say in opinion, that you got it wrong, or if you just state the appropriate fact.
Well, usually, and out of deference to the traditional fact finder,
yes,
you do not just summarily make findings apart from what were found, but you say that they were erroneous, or you accept them, which is generally the
right. I would, having litigated in the state of Indiana for 22 years, I can tell you that that is generally what happens.
Well, what about the point that I suspect is Judge Attini's point, that these quotes, the ones that Judge Rovner pointed out and that I followed up on, speak to their new policy about, you know, this is not a good way to go, that is the belt, but don't directly criticize or overrule the post-conviction trial court finding.
They do not explicitly state that the trial court, that the post-conviction court got it wrong. They do explicitly state that the belt was conspicuous to at least seven jurors. I believe that's the direct quote. That's pretty close.
Right.
And they do say, obviously, later counsel was proven wrong. It's not just an aside. I mean, we've got two affirmative statements by the court on an issue that is squarely in front of them and is up front and center on this claim. I suspect that the opinion might look a little different if had the court found that they didn't see the belt. I mean, why? Because they're talking about counsel opted for the stun belt because they were hoping the jury didn't see it. I mean, the question was the NES Supreme Court misapprehended, in our opinion, the Strickland question. You know, Wrinkles wasn't claiming they should have picked Shackles over stun belt. But in resolving that claim, the court makes the factual statement and moves on. Quickly, Indiana Rule Criminal Rule 24 does require that all proceedings, anytime the judge would speak to anybody, even the stuff about stun belt or shackles, should have been on the record. We do have proceedings when it's a capital case in Indiana that it is required by rule that these things are on the record. They just simply were not done in this case, contrary to rule. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, that rule existed prior to this trial, then, I guess.
Yes, sir. I know Mr. Kobe indicated that the lawyers were Criminal Rule 24 qualified. That was an issue in this case. There were some matters litigated during the post-conviction petition that suggested that the lawyers were not in compliance with Criminal Rule 24, which was in effect.
Were there any findings made on that?
Yes, I was just going to ask that.
Well, there were some findings on that. There was a motion post-hearing to hold in abeyance some findings because as a result of the noncompliance, the lawyers were referred to the Disciplinary Commission and the judge was referred to the Judicial Commission. That is what the record
these
reflects.
These were public defenders in Vandenberg County?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, we thank everyone and all counsel. And the case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.